as long as he does not violate the laws of justice, is left perfectly free to pursue his own interest, his own way, and to bring both his industry and capital into competition with those of any other man or order of men.
Adam Smith did not expect to see this system of natural liberty established in Great Britain. Manufacturers and merchants, with their monopolies enforced by law, constituted a formidable special interest, and they would stoop to virtually anything to prevent a system of economic liberty.
To expect, indeed, that the freedom of trade should ever be entirely restored in Great Britain is as absurd as to expect that an Oceania or Utopia should ever be established in it. Not only the prejudices of the public, but what is much more unconquerable, the private interests of many individuals irresistibly oppose it. This monopoly of trade has so much increased the number of some particular tribes of them that, like an overgrown army, they have become formidable to the government, and upon many occasions intimidate the legislature.
What would happen to a courageous legislator who, opposing monopolists, fought for free trade?
If he opposes them, and still more if he has authority enough to be able to thwart them, neither the most acknowledged probity, nor the highest rank, nor the greatest public services can protect him from the most infamous abuse and detraction, from personal insults, nor sometimes from real danger, arising from the insolent outrage of furious and disappointed monopolists.
It would be difficult to find a more bitter or sustained attack on capitalists than Adam Smith presents in The Wealth of Nations. Again, however, this is because individual capitalists were among the most dangerous foes of capitalism, a system of which Smith approved. When, after his treatment of mercantilism, Smith criticizes physiocracy, he comes to the defense of manufacturers and merchants. Physiocrats, remember, although they favored free trade, maintained that agriculture was the only form of productive labor. In his refutation of this view, Smith says the following:
"The increase in the quantity of useful labor actually employed within any society must depend altogether upon the increase of the capital which employs it. And the increase of that capital, again, must be exactly equal to the amount of the savings from the revenue, either of the particular persons who manage and direct the employment of that capital, or of some other persons who lend it to them. If merchants, artificers, and manufacturers are naturally more inclined to parsimony and saving than proprietors and cultivators, they are, so far, more likely to augment the quantity of useful labor employed within their society, and consequently to increase its real revenue, the annual produce of land and labor."
Mercantilists sought special privileges for merchants and manufacturers, and certain ancient civilizations, Smith points out, sought special privileges for agriculture. Smith opposes both. "Let free trade reign," he says, "and let everyone compete on equal terms."
Every system which endeavors, either by extraordinary encouragements, to draw towards a particular species of industry a greater share of the capital of the society than what would naturally go to it, or by extraordinary restraints to force from a particular species of industry some share of the capital which would otherwise be employed in it, is, in reality, subversive of the great purpose which it means to promote. It retards, instead of accelerating, the progress of the society towards real wealth and greatness, and diminishes, instead of increasing, the real value of the annual produce of its land and labor.
With his case for free trade complete, Adam Smith moves in the fifth and final book of The Wealth of Nations to discuss the revenue of the sovereign, or commonwealth. Because this part covers not economics per se, but the function and finance of 18th century governments, we shall not examine it here. There is a sense in which this section is tacked on and doesn't fit with the remainder of The Wealth of Nations, but we should understand why Smith includes it. Recall that The Wealth of Nations is an elaborate and systematic presentation of spontaneous order in the realm of economics. But a spontaneous order, Smith believes, cannot occur in a vacuum. The invisible hand, whereby the pursuit of self-interest serves the public good, can operate only if the rules of justice are observed. That is, only if the rights to life, liberty, and property are enforced. This is the primary function of government, according to Adam Smith, so he includes a discussion of governmental functions and finance in his treatment of the natural economic order. A just government provides the framework, so to speak, in which a spontaneous order can operate. In discussing the major economic themes and arguments contained in The Wealth of Nations, we cannot help but appreciate the difficult and intricate complexity of this magisterial book. Economics has been called the dismal science, and there are sections in The Wealth of Nations that will tax the patience of even the most dedicated reader. Yet there is a sense of humanity and charm about The Wealth of Nations, the book, just as there is a sense of humanity and charm about Adam Smith, the man. In what modern treatment of economics, for example, will we find remarks like this?
If the teacher happens to be a man of sense, it must be an unpleasant thing to him to be conscious, while he is lecturing to his students, that he is either speaking or reading nonsense, or what is very little better than nonsense. It must, too, be unpleasant to him to observe that the greater part of his students desert his lectures, or, perhaps, attend upon them with plain enough marks of neglect, contempt, or derision. No discipline is ever requisite to force attendance upon lectures which are really worth the attending.
Upon publication of The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith received congratulations from many quarters. The sentiments of Hugh Blair, a Scottish man of letters, expressed the views of many.
I cannot forbear writing to congratulate you upon your book. I have just finished it, and though from what you read to me some years ago, and from the great attention which I knew you had bestowed on the subject, I expected much, yet I confess you have exceeded my expectations. One writer after another on these subjects did nothing but puzzle me. I despaired of ever arriving at clear ideas. You have done great service to the world by overturning all that interested sophistry of merchants with which they had confounded the whole subject of commerce. Your work ought to be the commercial code of nations.
Adam Smith, that shy, awkward Scottish professor, choked with books and absorbed in abstractions, as Walter Badgett put it, was destined to change the course of world history. Badgett described the final days and influence of Adam Smith.
He died calmly and quietly, leaving directions about his manuscripts and other such literary things, and saying, in a melancholy way, I meant to have done more. That sort of fame which The Wealth of Nations has obtained, and its special influence, did not begin in his lifetime, and he had no notion of it. Nor would he perhaps have quite appreciated it if he had. His mind was full of his great scheme of the origin and history of all cultivation. As happens to so many men, though scarcely ever on so great a scale, aiming at one sort of reputation, he attained another. Like Saul, he went in search of his father's asses, and he found a kingdom.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of The Wealth of Nations from the Audio Classics series by Knowledge Products. This continuing series of cassettes presents the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context. The script for Tape 4 of The Wealth of Nations is by George H. Smith. Narration is by Craig Deitchman. Voice characterizations are by Dan Church, Rob Daniel, Travis Hardison, Joe Keenan, and Paul Meyer. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1985 by Carmichael and Carmichael Incorporated.